and steps on stage as music legend Buddy Holly, taking the audience back to the good old days of rock and roll with such rockin' in the aisle classics as That'll Be the Day, Peggy Sue, and Chantilly Lace. Ticket information at 1-888-261-9675.
Good morning and welcome to Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. In the first hour of the program today, we'll be talking about Burma. People who monitor human rights around the world say that Burma is one of the most repressive countries in all of Asia. Since 1962, the country essentially has been ruled by the military. And despite some fairly recent promises for reform, the government there continues to restrict the basic freedoms of its people. On the program today, we'll talk a little bit about politics of Burma and also about the efforts by activists inside the country who are working for democratic change and about how it is that it seems that on the international agenda, Burma and its regime seems to have been bumped up a little higher up the list of concerns recently. Our guest this morning in this part of the program is Mary Callahan. She is at the Jackson School of International Studies at the University of Washington in Seattle, and this is a special area of her focus, Burma and its politics. She's written a good deal on it. She's joining us this morning by telephone, and as we talk, questions are welcome. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. So people who are here where we are in this town can use that number to call in, but anyone is welcome to call. And if it would be a long-distance call, use the toll-free line. That is 800-222-9455. And if you're listening around Illinois and Indiana, use that number. In fact, even if you were listening on the Internet, as long as you're in the United States, you may also use the toll-free line. So again, 333-9455. That's for Champaign-Urbana. And toll free, 800-222-9455. Professor Callahan, hello.
Hello.
Thanks for talking with us today.
Yes, thank you for having me on.
Whenever we do something like this, I feel that it's important probably to, before trying to talk about what is happening now, to give people a little bit of background to help them understand what is happening now. And I'm sure that we probably could talk for a long time about the post-colonial history of Burma. But in brief, what should people know about Burma and particularly about its current government to help them understand where Burma is today?
I think that one of the important things to know about Burma is it is probably the longest running case of military rule in modern world history. Which means that this is not a government that is simply going to fade away very easily or going to be open to very simple kinds or a sort of simple menu of choices for a transition to democracy. The military first ruled briefly from 1958 to 60, then took over again in 1962. Ruled under the guise of a single-party socialist regime until 1988, when that iteration of military rule collapsed. There was a people power movement in 1988 that ended quite tragically when the military high command stepped back in and set up a new junta. And since 1988, that is the junta that is ruling to today.
One of the things that seems, as you say, that striking about Burma is that it seems that the government, and now at the moment, I guess we have to talk about the man, the general that has been in power since 1992, a man named Tan Shwe. It seems that he and the government doesn't particularly care about what the rest of the world thinks. It may indeed think about what its immediate neighbors think, and that may well be a key to this question of is there some way that you push Burma in the direction of change? But so the government, no doubt, are concerned about what the Indians think and what the Thais think and what the Chinese think and so forth. But when it comes to most of the rest of the world, it seems that the government doesn't particularly care what they think.
Yeah, you've hit on something really important. From our point of view, it does certainly appear that General Tan Shwe does not care, does not care what the rest of the world thinks, particularly in terms of the human rights abuses that the rest of the world has, I think, quite correctly censured them for. But I think that saying doesn't care is taking it a little bit too far. I would say that the fact is that what Senior General Fan Shui appears to worry about are a whole host of other things. And what the rest of the world thinks sometimes actually helps him to take care of other things that are higher on his priority list. In other words, the censure of the rest of the world sometimes actually helps him to take care of what he cares about the most, which is, I think, maintaining security in central Burma and never having another repeat of 1988. So I would say, again, I'm just trying to say to suggest that maybe that language isn't exactly right. It isn't that Fan Shui sort of has something pathologically wrong with him that he's willing to ignore the entire world. It's not that he's stupid. It's just that he has other things that are much higher on his priority list. Mm. As far as the neighbors go, there's always a great deal of ambivalence between the Burmese and all of their neighbors. And it's two-way ambivalence, I should suggest. The Burmese government has never particularly trusted the Indians or the Thais, and I think there is quite a lot of ambivalence among senior people in the military about the influence of China. Now, China is not using its influence to try to promote reform in Burma, but China's economic influence is enormous in Burma, and the Burmese military is very nationalist, and I'm quite sure there are a number of signs that this is very disturbing to them.
One of the things that seems to come across in some of the things that I have read is that, and you can check me on this and tell me whether or not this is correct, is that while there has been a lot of criticism from many from the international community of Burma and its government, and that some governments, for example, the United States and the UK, have imposed sanctions on Burma, that in fact there are in China, in Singapore, in Thailand, in India, there are people who like to do business in Burma and probably would be concerned that if things changed, it would affect their economic interests, and for that reason might be reluctant to put pressure on the government of Burma or to do anything that might upset things. Is that the case?
It's absolutely the case. I mean, the truth is that there is money being made out of Burma's economy right now. Very little of it is profit that is helping the Burmese people very much. But there are important interests, especially from China and Singapore, I'd say, that are doing very well in the existing setup. And so any time that you talk about reform, you're talking about change, and change always brings with it uncertainty. And so there certainly are, I think, vested interests that are somewhat comfortable with the way things are. So that's the broad picture, but let me also suggest that in the last year there have been a lot of changes in the elite structure in Burma. There was a purge within the junta last October, and there is a sense in Burma in day-to-day life, which includes some economic transactions that affect wealthy people, there is a sense that the rules that had been applying for 10 years no longer apply. 300 people from military intelligence and associated business partners were all arrested. And so that means that even for those who are profiting under the system, some of their security, I think, has been called into question. So broadly, I'd say there are vested interests that would like to see themselves continue to profit from the current setup. But the current setup has, over the last 12 months actually leaves them with a little bit of insecurity because they don't really know what the rules of the game are anymore.
Maybe I should just very quickly introduce again our guest for this part of Focus 580. We're talking with Mary Callahan. She is an associate professor in the Jackson School of International Studies at the University of Washington in Seattle. And we're talking about her main focus of her work, and that is Burma. Questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. You made reference to the purge of last fall, and I want to talk a little bit about that. And it's sort of a long setup, but essentially, about 2 years ago, a little bit more than 2 years ago, the man who was swept out last fall, a man who was at the time the prime minister, another general named Kin Yunt, proposed what he called a roadmap to democracy. And the ruling party said they're started to talk about having elections and also started to talk about reviving a constitutional convention that had been stalled for a long time. And last May, that convention actually started work. However, the leader of the very high-profile opposition party in the country, the National League for Democracy, Aung San Suu Kyi, the one Burmese person that people outside of Burma probably have heard of, she was not allowed to take part. I guess her party could take part, but she was still under house arrest. And so the party said, well, if she can't come, we're not going to take part. And that meant the whole thing was sort of a meaningless exercise. So then last year, this man was forced out and he was replaced by someone who was much more hardline, yet another general who said flat out that the government is not going to have anything to do with the National League for Democracy. He said something to the effect of, we're certainly not going to let them take over and we're not even going to talk with them. So that really makes one wonder, is there had been at some point some hope, at least the government was talking with its opposition. Now we have the representative of the government saying, we're not even going to talk to these people. What hope does that suggest that there is any hope for some kind of democratic change within the country?
Oh, God, you've hit exactly on the difficulty. There was a period in which there were high-level talks between the regime and Daw Aung San Suu Kyi, the leader of the Democratic Opposition. I also note that she was the recipient of the 1991 Nobel Peace Prize, which goes a long way to explaining why the world knows her name so well. There were talks, and they occurred periodically every 6 or 8 months. There would be a flurry of activity at her house where senior officials would go in, come out, and nobody ever knew what occurred in those talks. It's the best-kept secret in modern Asia, in my opinion. But if you visited Burma in 2001 or 2002 especially, there was a real sense that the military was open to some kind of transition. People talked all the time, at least in Rangoon, the capital, about power sharing, which meant, and, you know, people were speculating that certain cabinet ministries were going to go to the opposition and the military was going to hold on to the defense and interior. And so there was an enormous amount of hope for this. And then another event actually transpired, which I think is part of why we started hearing about the roadmap to democracy. Aung San Suu Kyi was actually quite brutally attacked on May 30th, 2003, by a group of thugs that are associated with the government in a kind of a nascent political party. A number of people were killed. We're not exactly sure how many. Aung San Suu Kyi was not injured, but she was returned to house arrest, where she still is today. The international community just really laid into the Burmese regime, as they should have, for this. And that was the moment at which Kenya emerged. He was suddenly moved from being secretary to the junta to being prime minister. He announced a roadmap to democracy. Clearly, this moment in which the regime, I think, was rather surprised by the overwhelming response of the international community. They were even censured by their neighbors. This was a moment that Kenyatta, who was probably to some degree a reformer, used to begin to promote reform. So he announced the roadmap to democracy, did, as you said, revive the Constitutional Convention. There were indications from some of Kenyatta's senior officials that he was actually open to letting Aung San Suu Kyi take over the National Convention, but when it opened in May, he wasn't even there when it opened. It was a very bad sign and was probably a sign of the beginning of the end for him. Is there hope for a transition? Well, I would never give up hope on Burma. Burma's sort of moment of kind of Rangoon Spring in 1988 happened as a result of something that was totally apolitical. It happened as a result of a tea shop brawl that spilled over into the streets. Thousands of people came out. I would maintain hope in this sense. I think the regime will push through some kind of a constitution. It will enshrine the power of the Temodaw, the armed forces, in politics. But once a constitution is on the books, you cannot always control the consequences that come from it. It's very possible a constitution might be something that could help. It could give the opposition some parameters for negotiations, some parameters for legal challenges. It's not going to be immediate. Democracy isn't going to come in the next 5 years in Burma, I don't think. But I don't think that you can write it off entirely.
No, one of the curious developments that I have read about here just recently is the government, the military government, announced that it was moving the capital from Rangoon to a place called Pyinmana, which is 600 kilometers north of Rangoon and is a very remote kind of rural location. And it seemed sort of strange, and a lot of people have said, well, why were they doing this? And it also sort of gives one of the impression of a government just drawing in on itself. The government, I guess, said something like it was strategically a better place, and in terms of security, it was a better place. But it's not an easy thing to move the seat of government 600 kilometers to the middle of what seems to be kind of like in the middle of nowhere, and which really makes you wonder, well, what exactly is the government thinking, and does this tell you something important?
I really have no idea what they're up to on the move to Pyinmana. The explanation that I've heard from people inside the country is there are two really popular explanations. And in Burma, there's a lot of censorship. People get news from listening to the BBC or Radio Free Asia broadcasts in Burmese on their shortwave radios. But the most powerful way in which people make sense of what's going on is through conversations, through immensely oral culture, and rumors are just extremely widespread. The two rumors that are the most prominent as to what the motivations are is one, an astrological reading that suggested that keeping the capital in Rangoon was going to be threatening to the karma of at least one of the senior generals. So one was an astrological reading, and the second was a fear of a U.S. invasion, which to listeners in the United States probably sounds insane, but I think there's probably a little something to it. The Burmese government is enormously sensitive to everything that is said by U.S. politicians. And if you actually just sort of sat down and looked at things that have been said by the spokespeople for the Bush administration or members of Congress, it actually is a pretty overwhelming list of complaints and threats. Now, none of them, nobody's actually threatening to send the U.S. military into Burma, but I think that the regime, with very little international experience of their own, perhaps overestimates the threat coming from the United States. Now, let me just suggest the evidence that this second explanation, that it's fear of a U.S. invasion. The evidence for this is that at Pimina, there is good evidence that the regime has actually built this underground bunker, which, according to some of those who work for construction companies in Pimina, is said to be ballistic missile-proof, which obviously suggests this is a place where the cabinet and the senior military officials can go if there was some kind of an attack. So the two prominent explanations are astrology and fear of the United States. But I actually would suggest that we take the regime at its word on this one. I actually think it is strategic. You have to remember this is a military government. And my own sense, as I hinted at earlier, is that this is a military government that never, ever again wants to see an uprising like 1988 in central Burma, in the capital city, Rangoon, capital city, Mandalay, or sorry, the other large city, Mandalay. The military was extremely traumatized by the unrest centrally. And a couple things I think are significant that may have led initially to thinking about Pimina, and that is that in 1988, soldiers actually joined the anti-government demonstrations. If you keep your soldiers in large numbers and also the military high command in Rangoon, then they are, in fact, vulnerable to some kind of an attack. Should there be a repeat of 1988. And the soldiers are vulnerable to being swayed into joining an uprising. So one thing is the worries of a repeat of 88 in that soldiers may be brought into an anti-government movement. Second thing is that in 1988, demonstrators raided some of the cabinet ministries. The demonstrators and maybe thugs and actually maybe some of the military itself raided cabinet ministries and really shut down the government. So my thought is that the military has been looking for ways for the last 17 years to make sure 1988 never happened again, and it's done a number of other things leading up to the Pimina thing. And Pimina is just one other portion of that strategic objective of protecting Burma from a repeat of 1988. Move the military high command, the cabinet ministries, the bureaucrats, the clerks, everybody who works for them, to a place in central Burma where they can actually be quarantined off if the country erupts in another uprising. They can actually, the military can actually surround Pimina and keep the government functioning. So, again, my sense is that it's complicated. Astrology and fear of the U.S. may have something to do with it. But I think that this is more of a strategic move.
Our guest in this part of Focus 580 is Mary Callahan. She is associate professor at the Jackson School of International Studies at University of Washington, Seattle, and has written a lot about Burma and its politics, including her book, Making Enemies, War and State Building in Burma. It was published in 2003 by the Cornell University Press. We do have a caller who's been waiting patiently, and we'll get right to them. Others are also welcome. 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. The caller here is in Indiana on our toll free line four. Hello.
Hello. Gosh, I guess I'd have to admit to, you know, deep ignorance about Burma. The last time I really was involved with Burma is when I had a nice stamp collection, and it was one of the countries I liked to collect their stamps. You basically answered the question I was going to ask, why this military group are doing what they're doing. So I think I'll move it to my second question, which has to do with the the religious aspect of Burma. Which religion has the largest adherents? Are there other groups? And if so, what are they? And I guess along the lines of the military people, are they fighting phantoms? Or is there anything real to any of these things you were just talking about? I know you talked about the uprising. I was wondering, are they overreacting, or is there seriously a possibility that groups would rise up against them? And if so, where would they get the guns and the ammo and stuff? Who in a sense, is supporting one group or another? Thanks a lot.
Mm-hmm. Great questions. Let me take the Fighting Phantoms question first, because it's actually closest to the last thing I was talking about. It is a really good question, and when Westerners go and visit Burma, it is always feels like a trip to a sort of bizarre Disneyland sort of thing, as one author wrote it. When you travel around in Burma, there are big signboards, billboards that say things like, crush all internal and external enemies, down with the minions of colonialism, anyone who interferes with the armed forces will be exterminated. Many of these are actually in English. And it feels really like overkill. It does really feel like the military is fighting phantoms. But I think that there is a little something more to it right now than there was maybe 10 years ago. And 10 years ago, I think the specter of 88 was even fresher in their minds. And so I think as we got away from that, it was possible to see this much more as fighting phantoms, as the military seemed to really deepen its control. It didn't seem like there was a whole lot of cause for all of this. There's one thing that happened this year, though, that I think is probably a proximate cause for the timing of the move to Pimina, and that's that a series of bombs went off in Rangoon last spring in three different locations, all almost at the exact same time, which shows coordination, it shows a degree of sophistication. This is not the kind of thing that happens regularly in Burma. There have probably been, over the last 17 years, maybe three or four instances of bombs discovered, bombs defused, or bombs going off in central Burma. So three of them going off on one day around the same time was quite shocking. Ordinary people were talking in terms that we've never heard them talk about, just general insecurity. These are ordinary people in Rangoon. One of those bombs went off across the street from a very important military installation. And my guess is that the Pimina thing was a sort of big, vast dream, and that the plans got moved up very quickly as a result of those bombs. Would the opposition ever get a hold of guns and ammo on a large enough scale to mount a credible or a viable challenge? It seems very unlikely. But they were able, I think, to really destabilize the regime, at least to a point where they are moving the high command and moving the government, which is, as you've both noted, an enormous undertaking. If I can move on to religions, mm-hmm. The major religion in Burma is Theravada Buddhism, which is probably practiced to some degree or another by 80% to 90% of the population. There are also Christians in Burma who are probably more than 3% to 6% of the population. And then there are also Muslims in Burma, particularly along the coastal areas, although every major city and many major towns also have groups of Muslims who live there. And then there are also animists and a small number of Hindus and a very tiny community of Jews in Rangoon. Buddhism is, however, obviously the predominant religion. The government has really clamped down on Buddhism in 1988. Many monks were actually deeply involved in the anti-government uprising, particularly in Mandalay. And so one of the other things that the government has done to make sure there's never a repeat of 1988 is attempt to control the monks in a much more sophisticated way than ever before. So monks have to be registered. There is much more of a kind of chain of command in what is the religious sangha or the monkhood is a kind of notoriously decentralized set of institutions, but the military has tried to bring them under central control. The military has also tried to co-opt the legitimacy associated with Buddhism. Senior military leaders are building pagodas all over the country and have been for the last 17 years. They are having photo ops with very important monks. They, I think, are attempting to show themselves as benefactors of Buddhism as one way of showing the population that they are all really on the same side. I'm not convinced it always works. When you visit new pagodas built by the military, they have generally put up all these paintings they've commissioned that show military officers talking to monks or building the pagoda itself, and those paintings are generally ignored in favor of the actual images of Buddha. So.
Well, I hope that that gets at the question of the caller. We have someone else. Others are welcome into the conversation here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Here's a caller in Charleston on our toll-free line, line 4. Hello.
Yes, I'm always intrigued by the subject matter that this program is about and the colonialism of Western Europe and the English, Portuguese and the English, you know, coming along as traders and then introducing the missionaries and then introducing a version of capitalism that then leeches off the natural resources and the population in the process. Then, I think it was in the 1960s that England gave up its colonial empire, and then the military regimes were installed both before the exit of the colonialist and then afterward, as your guest has been saying. And now, in these times, people like George Bush are suddenly going to introduce democracy. And I am just offended by these continuous references to democracy when in the world there is no such thing. The closest this comes is to republicanism. And republicanism is a representative form of government at every level. In the U.S. Congress, you know, there's about 550 people who make all the decisions that are spurred by capitalist enterprise, and somehow this is supposed to be a good for people, and it's always the elitism that rules and shall rule until there is some greater force that will expunge those types and actually begin to people friendly. And until now, there has been no such thing that I can see.
Well, I don't know how, Professor Callahan, you might respond to the comments of the caller. At the very least, it invites maybe having you talk a little bit about the how the colonial experience, perhaps, has helped to shape the place that Burma is today.
Yeah, the colonial experience, I think, is actually worth exploring, and I appreciate the caller's connection of Burma to things that are happening right now in the world, because it is a kind of remarkable moment in history when you find everybody on all sides of Western European and American politics, the right, the left, the center, all united to bring democracy to Burma. I mean, when you have Jesse Helms and Madeleine Albright saying the exact same thing, it's a kind of odd moment in world history. And I want to just suggest that one of the important things that the colonial experience did in Burma was that it really did set up an administrative system that to some degree persists to today in terms of the way territory was administered and ethnic identity was administered. The British, like they did everywhere else, used a kind of classic divide and rule system. They came into Burma, identified the ethnic majority group, who in English we call the Burmans. They're about 65% of the current population, 60 to 65%. And as they did everywhere else, they identified ethnic minorities, particularly those who had had contact with missionaries and knew some English. They identified ethnic minorities who they then promoted as district officials, as bureaucrats, as clerks, as police officers, and importantly, as members of the colonial army, the armed forces. Not surprisingly, when nationalism began to really take off in the 1920s and 1930s, it was largely a movement of ethnic Burmans who had been left out of most of the opportunities that capitalism brought with it from the colonial regime. And they were every bit as angry at the indigenous minorities who collaborated with the British as they were with the British. Now, the way in which the British ruled territorially was that, much like this regime, quite honestly, today, they worried about the center. And so in central Burma, they actually set up very direct and often quite repressive rule. In the ethnic minority regions of today, the British had originally set up quite indirect rule, where they simply cut deals with indigenous leaders. And the deals were things like, let us have access to your teak. As long as you do not impede commerce, you can do whatever you want up here. So it was much more indirect rule. Consequently, after independence in 1948, the regimes based in Rangoon have never actually exerted much control in ethnic minority regions. The insurgency, some of which was ethnically demarcated, that has plagued Burma since even before independence, it started in 1947, has largely been rooted in this area, these areas beyond the center, areas near the borders, areas where mostly ethnic minorities live. The drug trade, the growing of opium and the production now of methamphetamines all happens in those areas, not because there's anything particularly wrong with people living there, that they're swept up in illicit empires, but it's because Rangoon's never really had any control. So the division of the population in terms of identity created enormous animosities that still plague Burma to today. It also created, in terms of identity, a lack of understanding. People in central Burma really don't know very much about ethnic minorities, and vice versa. Ethnic minorities living in remoter regions probably know more about ethnic Burmans, but they haven't had a great deal of contact. And that's because of this administrative system that also further divided people. So I would say that still plagues Burma to today. David, I don't know if I can continue, but I just want to connect that back to the democracy thing.
Sure.
We can take a... Okay.
No, go ahead. Yeah.
Okay. To bring this back to the where I started on this and where the caller actually started on this about continuous references to building democracy around the world, it's actually my opinion that that the worldwide focus on democracy may have counterproductive consequences. Of course, we want to see democratic reform in Burma, and I would actually disagree with the caller in the sense that it isn't simply about who gets to make decisions over who gets what, when, where, and how. And, you know, so the members of Congress in the United States and the president, a very small elite, really corrupt our democracy. But one of the things that we do have in the United States are legal protections. Now, since 9/11, if you read the Patriot Act very closely, some of those legal protections have been eroded, but we still have a menu of ways in which we can protect ourselves from depredations of elites. In Burma, there is nothing like that. And so my hope is that some kind of a transition, while it may not give people as much say over their lives as we'd like, it would at least give them protections from depredation. So democracy is definitely important, but it's not the only thing. I actually think this age-old problem of the relationship between ethnic minorities and the ethnic majority group is much more central right now. As long as there isn't, and it's very clear there isn't going to be overnight a system of democratic governance that is going to emerge in Burma, I think it's really important to be building confidence, to be building linkages between ethnic minority groups and the majority. Remember that democracy is majority rule, and ethnic minority groups have to have viable minority rights built into any democracy. And a discussion of what those rights would be, I think, is probably every bit as important as a discussion of what democracy broadly would look like. The ethnic minority regions near the borders have been locked in civil war for at least two generations. If another generation is not going to grow up with child soldiers and with the threat of brutal counterinsurgency campaigns, I think some kind of rapprochement needs to occur between ethnic minorities and the democratic opposition based in the center.
We have about 10 minutes left, actually less than that. We have a caller we'd like to get in, and let me also introduce again our guest. We're talking with Mary Callahan. She is an associate professor at the Jackson School of International Studies at the University of Washington in Seattle, Washington, and we're talking about Burma, which is her main area of interest. Questions, welcome, 333-WILL, toll-free 800-222-WILL. Let's get to Champaign County here in line one. Hello.
Hi. You don't need to make much of this, but I'm just struck by last year there was an academic from Washington, one state from the Northwest, at least, who was on talking about this opening to democracy and was so hopeful about it. It seemed like there were some interests behind it or something. I don't know exactly. I'm just struck by that. It's odd that there's an opening to the East, I guess, out in the West. But putting that aside, when there was a lot made of the slave labor building the pipeline some time ago, still nothing was made of it that Halliburton had the contract for the offshore portion of that pipeline, and the pipeline isn't any good unless it goes somewhere. So there was a lot made of Unocal pulling out, et cetera, et cetera. But they still have ways of having offshore, et cetera, other agents doing the work, and it seems to me that there's, in a way, China's best interest is served having continuation of pariah status, because I understand they're getting sort of a fire sale price on the commodities, particularly hardwoods and things like that are going to the, and feeding the Japanese market too. Some, so it seems like, as you say, there are a lot of vested interests. But it seems to me that they aren't all in the East. And I really have to go. I'll hang up and listen on the air. Thanks.
All right. Well, can you comment on that?
Yeah. Let me talk about the China thing. It is certainly true that Chinese businesses and some Chinese businesses are actually attached to government agencies like the military. Chinese businesses are getting fire sale prices. One of the things that is most disturbing, I encourage your readers to look at two reports that have come from Global Witness, an international NGO that has done just heroic research inside of Burma, is that the environmental degradation that has occurred in the last 17 years by things like the fire sale, like atmosphere in which Chinese businesses have come up in and clear-cut tropical hardwoods. Global Witness has been able to document this. It's devastating. If you look at satellite pictures, there's an enormous change in Burma in the last 17 years. Chinese businesses are, in fact, doing quite well, for the most part, in these conditions. The only problem is that when there is uncertainty at the top, like there has been for the last 12 months, it's not always clear to Chinese businesses, business people, exactly how to maintain those optimal trading relationships. And so it's not clear who's in charge, and that means in Rangoon, but also in local regions. Many Chinese businesses had relationships with members of military intelligence, senior officers who are now in jail. And so I actually think the uncertainty of the last year is probably not good for their business. The second thing is that I would distinguish between the Chinese business people working in Burma and the Chinese government. The Chinese government is enormously worried about the drug trade that comes out of Burma, the very high HIV/AIDS infection rate in Burma. This, given the generally open conditions of the border, particularly with Yunnan, this is having a very deleterious effect on one of China's poorest provinces, Yunnan. And so I think that you actually have to disaggregate what you mean by China. I think that, once again, there is, within China, there are those who are generally doing well, but the government, I think, is actually quite nervous about the conditions in Burma as well.
Well, we're coming down to the point here where we have just a couple of minutes left, and now we have sketched out a very complicated political picture here in Burma. Having said all that, you know, let us say that the government of the United States or of the UK or the governments of Europe were interested in fostering movement toward democratic, peaceful democratic change in Burma. What sort of things could outsiders do? Is there, in fact, anything that outsiders could do?
I'm less convinced than ever that the United States can do anything, if we just start with the United States. I think the, as your earlier caller was talking about, I think that the rather reckless crusade-like activity of the United States, particularly in Iraq, has so weakened the position of the United States all over the world, in Southeast Asia as well, that I don't actually see the United States as anything but a blunt instrument that creates as many problems as it actually solves. That being said, if we had a sort of more enlightened position, if we as citizens could push our government toward a more enlightened position, I think that the way in which you could foster movement toward political reform that would really improve the day-to-day lives of people, and I'm not just using democracy here because I think the issue of minority rights is very important, is to move away from this knee-jerk reaction that we tend to have, we and Western Europe as well, of imposing sanctions just as black and white instruments. I think that we did, the United States did indeed, after Aung San Suu Kyi was attacked in May 2003, have to impose sanctions. But there should be benchmarks with sanctions. There should be a series of compromises that could be made. For example, after May 30th, 2003, when Suu Kyi was attacked, some things that we could have asked the regime to do were investigate the criminal acts. We also have interests over the long haul in seeing political prisoners released, and the regime actually has released a lot of political prisoners. With each benchmark that the regime can meet, and what that does is actually empower reformers within the regime, with each benchmark that is met, then you provide perhaps new kinds of assistance, new kinds of opportunities. So I would argue that if we had more enlightened leaders, it would be very worthwhile to be thinking about revising sanctions and providing for benchmarks. I want to add just one other thing, which is that it's completely unconscionable that the United States just led the effort to pull the Global Fund for the Fight Against AIDS, Tuberculosis, and Malaria out of Burma. This was strictly, as near as we can tell, in decision that was engineered by Washington. And the Global Fund and the variety of organizations that have worked for it in Burma have built in so many safeguards to make sure that the military regime did not skim the money off. That was an enormous amount of money that was already paying dividends in terms of laying the foundations for making people's lives, people in the most difficult situations, making their lives better.
Pardon me for having to jump in on you, but I simply must because we're at the end of the time. I'm sorry, but we're going to have to stop. Mary Callahan is our guest. She is Associate Professor at the Jackson School of International Studies, University of Washington. Professor Callahan, thank you very much for talking.
Thank you very much.
Support for the show comes from the Infant Parent Institute with offices in Champaign. The Infant Parent Institute is a private clinical practice and research institute dedicated to supporting the mental health of young children and their families. Information on the web at infantparent.com. Support also comes from World Harvest International and Gourmet Foods, 6th and University in Champaign.